Imagine going to see your son or daughter's school principal and then discovering the administrator you meet is wearing a body camera to record your discussion. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we find out why the Burlington Community School District is taking this unusual step, among the first in the nation to do so. Also, distress over the governor's line item vetoes. A new bill in Washington looks to bump up medical research funding, how to make exercise a habit that's hard to break, and a preview of RAGBRAI 43. Buckle up for your News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Monday of this week, House Democrats called for a special legislative session. This came after Governor Terry Branstad vetoed funding for education and for the Mount Pleasant Mental Health Institute. Now, that session didn't get the two-thirds of the votes needed from both houses to convene. Here with us to discuss these vetoes and the reaction to them, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell. Hello.
Hi, Ben.
Tell us more about these vetoes that came at the end of last week.
Well, they were money for K-12 education, money for the Regents Universities, and as you said, money to keep the mental health institutes at Clarinda and Mount Pleasant open beyond the June 31st deadline when they, in fact, closed. These were in bills in such a way that it was easy for the governor to use his line item veto. It wasn't part of the rest of the education spending where the governor would have had to either sign or veto the whole thing, and then you would have to come back in special session. You have to have some money for schools. It was written in such a way that he could just veto that sort of by itself spending.
Mm-hmm. Kindergarten through 12th grade funding has been really a contentious issue this session. But I guess, you know, we thought that was a resolve by the end of this session. This was a big surprise. And looking at the reports, also what came into my email inbox, there were some people outraged by what the governor did.
Yeah, I wouldn't say surprised, but the outrage is definitely there. This was a, you know, as you know, it was a hard-won battle between Republicans and Democrats over K-12 spending, which dragged on for weeks. Then finally, Democrats emerged and said, essentially, this is the best we can do. And they got this extra $55 million for schools, but they got it in this, it wasn't part of the base spending for education. That was the best they could do. And now this, to me, it's a little bit prophetic to look back and say, this is the best we can do, meaning it's out there. The governor has vetoed this one-time, so-called one-time spending in the past. So I shouldn't say surprise, but, you know, schools had been waiting to hear from this. The legislature, bipartisan legislature, passed it. And so, of course, there's disappointment.
Mm-hmm. So they were just merely trusting the governor to do what they wanted him to do, and he didn't have to do that.
That's right.
Okay.
He didn't have to do that. And you might look at this as another example that the Republican governor and the Republican legislature do not walk in lockstep.
Mm-hmm. Now, Democrats attempted and failed to call this special session. It didn't happen, didn't get the two-thirds vote in both houses. When was the last time that happened? Do those special sessions get called very often?
They don't happen very often. The last one, I believe the last one was in 2006. And that year, the legislature passed a property rights bill, a bill to limit the ability of government to condemn property by eminent domain. That was a bipartisan supported bill passed the legislature, and Governor Vilsack vetoed it. And in that instance, they did get the two-thirds vote to call themselves back into session, and they got the two-thirds vote to override that veto. Before that, in 2001, it's kind of an interesting situation. In 2001, that was a recession, a serious recession, and Governor Vilsack made an across-the-board cut in order to address this, you know, declining state revenues. that's the only thing that a governor can do. You know, the governor can't say, well, we're going to change this appropriation, change that. All he could do was do an across-the-board cut, which nobody liked. And so the Republicans and Democrats negotiated ahead of time. They said, I believe it was a one-day, maybe two-day at the most special session, and they restored some of those cuts, so much for public safety, so much for education, which only the legislature can do.
Mm-hmm. Another part of the veto that we mentioned, but I would like you to talk a little bit more about the bulk of it, was concerning education that the governor vetoed here for K through 12, but also for community colleges and state universities. Another $6.4 million would have been used to restore services at the Mental Health Institute in Mount Pleasant for another year. There is a continued big disagreement about between Branstad, the governor, and his party when it comes to mental health in the state, isn't there?
Well, the situation at Mount Pleasant was, as you said, the governor made clear. He put that in his agenda. The first day of the session, that was in his agenda, close the mental health institutes at Mount Pleasant and Clarinda. That took some people by surprise, although there had been talk about that over the years. And so immediately there was an effort underway to keep that from happening. And in fact, you know, it was a bipartisan effort. Republicans represent Mount Pleasant and Clarinda. And so with their help, the legislature agreed to keep it open. But again, this was put in the budget in a way that funding could be vetoed. We may not have heard the last of this because the Public Employees Union has threatened to sue the governor over this. If that sounds kind of deja vu, the AFSCME folks sued the governor when he closed the juvenile home in Toledo. That went all the way to the Iowa Supreme Court, and AFSCME lost that. They're arguing that this is different because the legislature actually appropriated money for those, mm-hmm. and the governor is closing them anyway. So I wouldn't speculate on the chances for that, but I think the chances that AFSCME will sue over this are pretty good.
Mm-hmm. What did the governor say in his defense against the outrage about the education and mental health cuts?
Well, he believes in what he calls responsible budgeting, and he has said before he has vetoed one-time spending in the past, so-called one-time spending, where you set this money aside, put this money in the budget for ongoing expenses. So he doesn't want money to be put out there and then they're used for ongoing expenses, and that sort of sets up an expectation for the following year. And he doesn't like that. Actually, Republicans don't like, in the House and Senate didn't like that either. But they were, after weeks of negotiation, they were able to come to a way to consider that one-time spending for one-time money. But it was a little bit convoluted and didn't meet the governor's
mm-hmm. Do you expect these issues, Joyce, before we say goodbye, these issues to pop up back in the next legislative session come January 2016?
Well, I guess if a lawsuit worked, that would be back, but I think that's unlikely. And of course there'll be another fight over education spending next year, no doubt.
Okay. Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell, thanks for keeping us up to date, Joyce.
Okay, thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end the week. We like to do this on Fridays to catch up on some of the news that we didn't get to otherwise in our talk shows. The Burlington Community School District is taking an unusual step. The school district along the eastern Iowa border is thought to be among the first in the nation to outfit administrators at each of the district's 8 school buildings with body cameras. Pat Cohen is the superintendent of the Burlington Community School District and joins me now. Superintendent Cohen, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So let me get this straight. I come in to talk to a principal about my son or daughter, and there will be a body camera on that person's clothing.
There very well may be. What we have, we're developing the policy. And in that policy, there is great latitude for the administrator to use discretion. There's a balance with our public school administrators where they have to foster trust and belief that we are doing the best things for their child at the right time in the right way. And if the administrator feels that the camera would be a detriment, it will not be used.
Mm-hmm. In what cases would it be a good idea to use the camera? What are the parameters you're setting out for the case where it would be beneficial?
Absolutely. An example, earlier this school year, we had a child claim that one of our administrators kicked him repeatedly. We have cameras on our buses. We have cameras in our buildings. We have cameras outside of our buildings. And by using the fixed cameras in the building, we're able to clearly understand and see that the child was not kicked and was not abused. So the camera would come in handy. As long as we have the right policies and practices in place, this should be a win-win for everybody.
Mm-hmm. So someone, listeners who haven't been in public schools for perhaps many years may not know that public schools in the meantime have, as you just mentioned, cameras all over.
That's correct. That is correct. We have cameras in all of our buildings, outside all of our buildings, and inside all of our buses.
Mm-hmm. And so this, it sounds like you're describing merely an extension of that. This is another camera that happens to be worn by a principal.
That's correct. And we would limit it to use within our policy. We have procedures that take place during discipline, and part of that is recording the event. And we use a student management system, and all the details are entered into that event. So if things would become heated, an angry parent begins to swear, scream, knock stuff off our desk, those type of things. Not that that happens a lot, but if and when it does, we would be able to click the camera on.
Mm-hmm. So am I understanding correctly that perhaps this is only certain conversations, a minority of conversations that have been red flagged for one reason or another?
It has, and it is. We do not, absolutely, we do not want to be intrusive. We respect people's privacy. We just have to make sure that we do things in the best interest of all parties involved.
Mm-hmm.
Not only the administrator, but also the child, also the parent, the community, those type of things. And we look at this as a tool that we can use to not only help curtail some of the situations that may escalate, but we also are looking at this as a data source that we can drop into our continuous growth model, and we can look at and say, are we representing ourselves the way that we need to be representing ourselves through our conduct?
Mm-hmm.
So I've always told staff, because cameras have been in schools for decades, most likely, and the camera can be against us as well as it can somebody else if we don't maintain a certain degree of professionalism in our actions.
And this is also to protect your school system, your school district, legally.
That is correct. Yes, we could. There's instances where people have made accusations against staff, against other students, and the cameras help a great deal in being able to weed through the points of view and the perspectives and boil it down to the truth.
Now, as the word about this has gotten out, what sort of feedback have you received from parents, other people?
Surprisingly, several news agencies have interviewed children, students, and the students are supportive. For the most part, they've grown up in a time frame where they've all have cameras in their pockets, and everywhere they go, they're being filmed, and the kids haven't said anything bad about it. Now, I do believe that there will come a time when a parent will become upset with the camera, and at that time, our plan is to discontinue the meeting, excuse the child, let the parent take the child, and we'll come back the next day before school when everybody's calm and the emotions have gotten under control, and then we'll try to pick up the resolution at that point.
Hmm. What other sort of pushback have you gotten here against this move of outfitting your administrators with body cameras? Some are citing overreach or privacy concerns. How do you answer these?
Well, we in our handbook, we already explained that cameras are used on the campus. Any school in Iowa is required by law to have that in their handbooks if they have cameras, which most schools do. So we haven't really got pushback on that because the law is very clear. Bathrooms, locker rooms, those type of things, there is an expectation of privacy. In a public place, such as a public school, the expectation of privacy isn't as high. And again, the key to this is that we have to hold a high-quality training with our administrators before deploying the cameras and help them develop their ability to determine, am I or am I not going to use the camera? We won't have them on just generally walking the halls. We won't have them on talking in a general conversation. They would only be turned on before the discipline process would begin.
Mm-hmm. Sort of a potentially tense conversation might get started, or controversy would be discussed.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Do you think in the years to come, Superintendent Cohen, that body cameras on school administrators will become more the rule than the exception?
I think it will. Because that's the way our society is going anyway. If you go into any business or you walk up to an ATM machine, you're most generally being filmed. And again, it's for everybody's best interest, you know, and safety.
Okay. So what happens when your first student walks into one of your schools and that student is outfitted with a body camera?
Well, they do that now.
They do?
Yes, they do. I have reviewed many videos that students have taken. Maybe a teacher wasn't engaging in instruction. Maybe a substitute was behaving in a way that was less than desirable. And I have reviewed films of students that students have taken in the schools. And there are websites, angryteachers.com, where kids are filming all the time in our schools.
All right. Okay, Superintendent Cohen, thank you for this conversation, and welcome, I guess, for all of us to the smile you're on candid camera era.
Well, thank you very much, and sadly, that is where we're going.
All right. Take care.
You're welcome.
If you're just joining us, it's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, catching up on news items we didn't get to otherwise during the week. How about this? The future of cancer research in Iowa and across the country is hanging in the balance as members of Congress consider the passage of legislation called the 21st Century Cures Bill. The bill would boost medical research funding for the National Institutes of Health by a mandatory $8.75 billion over 10 years. Joining us now by phone, Dr. George Wiener, director of the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of Iowa. He's also president of the Association of American Cancer Institutes. Dr. Wiener, thank you for joining us again.
Glad to be here.
Now, give us an idea of what this bill would mean to research and cancer research here in Iowa and around the country.
We're extremely excited about the possibilities here. In biomedical research in general and cancer research in particular, it's an incredibly exciting time as we start to unravel the nature of cancer and how it interacts with the rest of the body. It brings out all sorts of opportunities for us to develop new approaches to prevention, early detection, and therapy.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to gauge what nearly $9 billion over 10 years means in the context of the National Institutes of Health. Is that significant?
Well, it is, and it's particularly significant when you look at the fact that over the past decade, the buying power of federal research funding for medicine has actually dropped by 26% if you take inflation into account.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, in our mind, a bending of the curve back in the right direction and would provide us with some of the resources that would be very important. As a matter of fact, just 2 days ago, just yesterday actually, I was at a meeting at the NCI And part of what we talked about is the wonderful opportunity that this funding would present if it actually comes to pass.
Mm-hmm. So funding for the NIH has declined by more than 24% since 2003. Why now? Why now the about face on funding? Why the attitude change in Congress? Because I understand this is supported by, in a bipartisan fashion.
Well, I wish I understood, and we would have tried to do it earlier. But the fact is that I think everybody recognizes that investing in the NIH is good for the economy. It drives innovation. Biotechnology is a huge industry for our country, that it enhances our communities because the vast majority of that money goes to cancer centers like ours and medical centers across the country. And perhaps most importantly, that the opportunity to reduce pain and suffering from diseases like cancer has never been greater.
Mm-hmm.
What we're seeing is that the politicians are beginning to get past the partisan bickering and look at this very important effort that has bipartisan support, and we're hopeful that they'll be able to do something about it this year.
I wonder if a fear of falling behind research in these areas in other countries has spurred Congress to really work in a bipartisan fashion.
I think that is one of the factors, because you see many other countries, China, India, Singapore, really investing in biomedical research. And for some of the talented people we have in this country, some of them have actually gone overseas. And I think that that's one of the factors that the politicians are looking at. We're just very excited that this may present us with the opportunity to pursue some of the outstanding ideas that we've sort of had to put on the back burner because of a lack of available funding.
Tell us about some of those ideas. I know you're doing so many things at the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center in Iowa City. What would this funding mean? What would it take off of the back burner and put onto the front burner?
Well, I can tell you that, out of all the grants that are submitted across the country, about 10% of those that are felt to be worthy are actually funded. So it's a huge number of research ideas that are going unfunded. A lot of them actually relate to trying to figure out how to take our advances in understanding the molecular causes of cancer and develop specific treatments based on those problems. The idea is that these treatments are going to be much more specific and have fewer side effects than current treatments. And we're starting to see that to come to the fore. And this will allow us to move those ideas forward faster.
Before we go, quickly, Dr. Wiener, how optimistic are you that this will pass into law?
Well, I'm hopeful. We don't understand all the details of what's being discussed. I know it's changing almost hour to hour right now, with amendments being offered, some that we think are constructive, some that we're less enthusiastic about. We're continuing to voice our opinion about what we think is best for the field of biomedical research. We remain hopeful, but I can't really put a number on it. Just hope that the politicians can get past, again, any issues related to politics and see what's good for the people of this country.
Okay, Dr. George Wiener, director of the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of Iowa, also president of the Association of American Cancer Institutes, talking about a bill being considered, the 21st Century Cures Bill, that would boost medical research funding for the National Institutes of Health significantly. Dr. Wiener, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
Coming up after a short break, a preview of this year's RAGBRAI, the Register's annual Great Bike Ride Across Iowa. We'll talk to the director of RAGBRAI and also with Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register, Kyle Munson. Also, in our second half, how to make regular exercise a habit that's hard to break. And we'll congratulate and introduce you to, something new here at Iowa Public Radio, our new 24-hour Studio One stream. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment. It's your NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, you'll want to stay tuned for a preview of RAGBRAI 43, the Ride Across Iowa. We'll be talking with RAGBRAI director T.J. Juskowitz and Kyle Munson of the Des Moines Register. But first, keeping on the exercise theme here. It's not so much what you do, but how you get yourself to exercise that matters, making it a habit that's hard to break. That's according to a new study put out by Iowa State University. Allison Phillips joins me now, assistant professor of psychology at Iowa State University in our AIMS studio. She's the lead author of this study, published this week in Health Psychology. Professor Phillips, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. It's good to be here.
Allison, I'm going to turn up your mic for one thing and then ask you, what is the question that you looked at?
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. This research study was to investigate if there are different aspects of exercising that can be habitual and to determine which one of those is most important for sticking with exercise overall in the long term.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find?
Well, we found that what we call an instigation habit, or the habit of deciding to go exercise, is more important for exercise frequency and maintenance than something we called execution habit, which is more automatically going through the motions once you are exercising.
Okay, you'll have to explain a little bit about the difference between instigation and execution habits.
Sure.
Please.
Okay. Well, for example, I have a strong instigation habit, as you may guess, being an exercise researcher and a health psychologist. So every day after work, in the process of packing up to go home, I automatically decide it's time to exercise. And I most often go to the gym, but not always. So my execution habit strength is low. I don't have a strong execution habit because when I decide to go exercise automatically, I then choose what I want to do. What do I feel like doing? Do I want to go to the gym, or is the weather nice? I might go for a run.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a separation there. Some people have strong habits in both ways. They automatically choose to go exercise given their cue, and then they always do exactly the same routine. But our research shows that you don't have to do the same routine. It doesn't have to be an automatic execution of behavior in order for you to stick with it over time. And I think that's the hopeful part for people, that they don't have to do the same boring routine if that's not what they want to do. And they don't have to worry that they will be derailing their overall habit, and they don't have to worry about quitting overall.
What about for those of us who don't exercise as regularly as we would like to, but would love to create a habit that we couldn't break? How do we go about that?
Well, that's an ongoing research question, certainly. The best ways to help individuals develop habits in the first place, especially difficult ones like exercise habit. But I can tell you a couple of things based on my own research and research of Benjamin Gardner, who was my co-author on this paper. Two things to keep in mind. One, when you're starting out exercising, it will be difficult at first. The habit has to develop with repetition over time. So there is that initial phase when it's not automatic. But I would recommend starting out doing the behavior, exercising in a stable context to help those cues develop in the first place, so that they can eventually trigger your automatic decision to go exercise. And the second thing I would recommend is to choose something that you find really enjoyable. So it doesn't have to be enjoyable at first. I mean, exercise is not always pleasant, but the more you can choose something that you naturally enjoy, the quicker it will become a habit.
Mm-hmm. What about a buddy or a group to exercise with? How does that fit in?
Sure. A lot of people find enjoyment in being active with other people. We know that older adults and also very young individuals get more from the social aspect of being active than they do, you know, the actually physically active part. So it depends on what you find enjoyable. But certainly if that's something that would reward you, choose going with a friend. And then that also helps with making the context stable, because you have to schedule with a friend. So that would probably hit both of my recommendations.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Allison Phillips, thank you very much. Assistant professor of psychology at Iowa State University, lead author of a study published this week in Health Psychology about how to make exercise habitual in your life. Allison, thanks.
Thank you.
RagBri 43 kicks off with its first of 7 days of riding in just over a week. Thousands of Iowans on 2 and 3 wheels, along with the rare unicyclist or skateboarder, will spend a week making their way across the state from the west to the east, and along the way having a tremendous time visiting all the communities they pass through. Joining us with a preview of this year's route, the 43rd, T.J. Juskiewicz is with us, director of the Register's annual Great Bike Ride Across Iowa, RAGBRAI, and Kyle Munson, Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. T.J. and Kyle, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Thanks, Ben.
T.J., let me start out with you. Give us some of the highlights for this year's route. We're going from, let's just run across from the, I'll go run quickly from the west to the east, Sioux City, Storm Lake. These are the overnight towns. Sioux City, Storm Lake, Fort Dodge, Eldora, that's the smallest overnight stop, Cedar Falls, Hiawatha, then down to Coralville, and ending up in Davenport.
You got it. It's kind of a retro route. We did the first RAGBRAI before it was even called RAGBRAI. We went from Sioux City to Davenport. It's the first time in 43 years that we've actually did that starting and ending town. So it's kind of a neat kind of throwback, if you will, to that original route in 1973. And we do visit some of those towns that were on that original route. Storm Lake and Fort Dodge were also on there. So it's kind of neat to go back in time. And those towns have definitely changed since 1973, but so was RAGBRAI.
Mm-hmm. There are some towns, meeting towns and so forth, that have never seen RAGBRAI on this year's route, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. We're always trying to pick up a few. I think we've been to close to 900 towns right now. Some towns are unincorporated villages, if you will. We try to get to all of them, but it's impossible. We're picking up, I'd say, about 10 this year alone.
Mm-hmm. I see this year you're featuring RAGBRAI's first gravel loop on the second day from Storm Lake to Fort Dodge. This is an optional, I don't know, 10 or 15 mile loop. I'm not going to ask you why it's taken so long, because anybody on a bike knows why you don't necessarily want a bike on a gravel road. So why have you done that this year?
Well, it's definitely getting popular in our state, and we've probably got some of the best gravel roads in our entire nation, just because of the farm-to-market system and just having, you know, pretty much a gravel road every mile in our state. So we just kind of figured we used to try to avoid gravel at all costs for RAGBRAI, but since it's become popular, we just might as well throw it in as an added bonus.
Okay, for people who don't understand, what is the attraction of gravel?
Well, it's just kind of, you know, people want to get a little dirty out there, and it's just a different mentality when you're riding on the road compared to gravel. You got to think about every pedal stroke, and
indeed,
you're definitely a lot less cars, probably a few more pigs and hogs or cows and all that, but it'll be fun. And Pomeroy is going to be one of those first time towns. Wow, that's a tongue twister.
There you go.
So they'll be hosting. They've got a neat little establishment there called Byron's. That's one of the best-known live music venues in our entire state. So gravel riders will be in for a treat.
Okay. Kyle Munson, you are the Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. You like to pedal along and write about it. What excites you most about this year's route?
Yeah, definitely. I'll be out there, and my colleague Mike Moraine, too. We like to, you know, call it work for a week when we go sit, you know, across the state on our bikes with TJ and everybody else. Speaking of that gravel loop, you know, it has been amazing, just the rise in popularity of fat tire bikes. And so, you know, that has driven a lot of it. And I remember, having grown up in rural Iowa on a gravel road, I started out riding gravel because there was nothing else to bike on, but I won't be doing the gravel loop probably this year. I'll just have my road bike. But, you know, I love, it's the whole, this is the Iowa's best rolling rural circus, you know, international circus that visits all these small towns. And I just love everything from, you know, last year I was biking alongside the mayor of Fort Worth, Texas, or, you know, people like Lance Armstrong have been out there, or I just love meeting fellow Iowans or somebody from, you know, Guatemala, whatever it is. It's just the whole serendipity of RAGBRAI is the thing I look forward to.
Isn't that really the charm of it? Of course, the towns you go through, the welcome you get in all these towns, and the charming things you get to experience and the townspeople and so forth. But really what you just spoke to, Kyle, is, you know, you have maybe a 10-second conversation or a 2-minute conversation with somebody you catch up with, or someone catches up with you and passes you, and it's really quite, I don't know where that conversation happens otherwise in a life, but it's really interesting.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, It's always been a heartening example for me of, you know, something that, you know, a couple of these journalists started just on a whim so long ago, and it really still has that core ideal of shared humanity, common humanity. Nobody locks up their bikes. You're right. Everybody, it's a disarming.
You're not supposed to say that.
Well, yeah, right. That's right.
It's okay. A magical place. How's that?
A magical place where, you know, we're, you know, everybody realizes that you're supposed to take it down a notch or two and just have fun and kind of relate to everybody.
Right. Speaking of the origins of this, TJ, for those who don't know, how did this all start in 1973? It was sort of a challenge.
Yeah, there was a guy named John Karas who kind of came up with the concept along with a colleague, Donald Call, and they basically wanted the register to pay for their vacation across the state on a bicycle.
Just like Kyle.
Yeah.
Right, that's right.
And they invited the readers to come along and you know, ride with them. 144 people started off in Sioux City. By the time it went through Des Moines, there was 500 people that were on the ride. So over those 43 years, they never dreamed it would even have a second run. And here we are 43 years later. And Karas will actually be out there on the Karas Loop Day giving out patches. So John's in his mid-80s, and he plans to ride a little bit with us. So what he started back in 1973 is still going strong.
Right. Every year features a century loop where you can have one day where you can choose to go over 100 miles and get that patch. And
you bet.
And now, not only has it become a tradition here in Iowa, but this is, it's fair to say, isn't it, TJ, that this has inspired similar bike rides, maybe not a week long, but many of them are similar across the country. Many states envy Iowa for having such a great tradition, don't they?
Oh, you bet. And Flattery, you know, seeing all those other rides throughout our country and then some foreign rides as well. You know, we kind of think that ride over in France this week is kind of stole our idea.
The Tour de France, okay.
During the summer. Yeah. But you know, there's probably 48 states that have a similar type ride. Most of them are much, much smaller. I think ours is probably 5 to 10 times larger than the next one of its size.
Mm-hmm. Ragbri known across the nation, but worldwide as well. You have people coming from all different countries, don't you?
Yeah, you bet. And I think Kyle could probably speak about one of those special teams that we have this year, probably the most internationally diverse teams we've ever had.
Kyle.
Yeah, well, there is a Team Shurzanon. Yeah, will be they'll get here at the end of next week and come to Des Moines and gather in Des Moines. It's a group of female Muslim athletes, and it's a really unique situation. So it's a combination of one of the co-founders went to school and grew up in Urbandale, and so she and some of her friends from this who are all turning 50 from this class of Urbandale. She has since done a lot of work in New York and elsewhere, and aligned herself with a publisher and some other women who are really doing what they can to kind of promote goodwill and peace.
Mm-hmm.
And they have roots in kind of this growing world of female Muslim sport, and so they're trying to kind of use their Ragbri team as a gesture of kind of cross-cultural appreciation, goodwill, and that sort of a thing. And so we're going to have, I mean, I think it's a mixture of like a mountain climber, there's a swimmer, I mean, all these different kind of accomplished athletes from around the world and some Muslim countries are going to be riding as a distinct team, and that's going to be something really unique on Ragbri this year.
Got about a minute left. Of course, you don't know what weather necessarily you're going to get, but in July, of course, it can be hot and humid. It turns out that our cool weather this week is changing this weekend. Sad. TJ, this would have been a perfect week, would it not have been?
Sure would. we'll take whatever they give us because, okay, you know, it's going to be fun no matter what.
Yeah, it is. And you can, you know, you have hints, I know, in the Des Moines Register about safe riding also during severe weather. We had some very severe weather last year heading out of Waverly. I remember that 20 to 30 mile an hour winds, drenching rain. We were drenched and shivering. I took refuge in the Tripola High School. I don't know where you guys were.
I was on a screen porch getting coffee from some kind Iowa folks, so that's where I ended up.
You remember that, TJ? Where were you when that storm hit?
Well, we were just making sure we didn't need blankets for people, which usually is not a problem on Ragbri. So, you just never know what the day is going to bring. And it could be 105 degrees. It could be, you know, 40 degrees. And, you know, again, no matter what, people have prepared for the worst and hoping for the best out there. No matter what, it's going to be fun.
Okay, very quickly, if someone is interested and doesn't have a ticket or a wristband yet, TJ, can they still get in and do this?
You bet. Currently, right now, during this week, we still have them available in the lobby of the Des Moines Register down at 400 Locust. And if on the ride at our baggage trucks in the morning, they can buy a day pass at $25 a pop, and they can also buy them at the merchandise trailers at night.
Very good. TJ Jeskowitz, director of the RAGBRAI, and Kyle Munson, Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. See you out on the road, guys.
All right, there, Ben.
And finally, on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, this week marked the launch of Iowa Public Radio's 24-hour Studio One stream. That's an expanded version of our Studio One programming. Joining us to share more about the new service, Iowa Public Radio Music Director Al Scherz. Hi, Al.
Hello. How are you, Ben?
Great.
Good.
And even better with this new service on board of Iowa Public Radio. Tell us about it.
Well, we're super excited. I mean, what we've done is we've taken the Studio One stream that people already hear on air, and we've beefed it up. And throughout the day now, you can hear Studio One. You can hear Studio One tracks in the morning. You can hear World Cafe in the morning. You can hear a brand new show that features local artists called Gas Money. You can hear that at noon. You can hear repeats of some of our weekend programming between 1 p.m. and 4 p.m. in the afternoons. There's a new program called Rust on the Dial in the schedule, which focuses on Americana and roots music. So there's a bunch of new material and additional chances to hear the material that you already hear on our on-air Studio One stream. So 24 hours a day, we want to be your daily soundtrack.
For those not that well acquainted with our Studio One service, how would you describe it to people?
Well, you know, it's always difficult to describe what it's basically in the industry, it's called a AAA service. And that doesn't tell you much either. So it's hard to describe exactly, but it's a really wide-ranging, eclectic mix of material. I've always kind of considered it, you know, new music, rock and roll music that has been influenced and continues to be influenced by a wide variety of things like folk music and blues and world music. R&B and soul. It has all of those influences, but it's new and old material. It's just a very eclectic mix of material. You'll hear everything from Bob Dylan to the Flaming Lips.
Mm-hmm. We've been enjoying this the Studio One service for many years now. This expanded service. I know you've been working on this idea for a long time, and now it's finally arrived. What was the genesis of the idea? Why have this expanded service?
It's obvious that Iowa's working really hard to develop a vibrant music scene. I think you see that in the number of new bands that are coming together all over the state. And you see that in the number of festivals that are happening all over the state. We have 8035 happening this weekend, the Hinterland Festival coming up in Des Moines, the Mission Creek Festival in Iowa City, the Iowa City Jazz Festival. We just had the Gentlemen of the Road stop over in Waverly. The music scene just really seems to be humming right now. And we realized that if we worked just a bit more efficiently and put a few things together on the operations side of things, we could launch a 24-hour Studio One stream online and really be there for people who love this kind of music 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, how can people tune in?
Well, you can tune in just by going to iowapublicradio.org, and you can also download a brand new mobile app that we have at Iowa Public Radio. You can get that at the iTunes Store, a free app at the iTunes Store, or you can get the free mobile app at Google Play if you have an Android device. So free mobile app, or you can just go to our website and click into it there.
Okay, Iowa Public Radio Music Director Al Scherz, congratulations on this new era of the Iowa Public Radio 24-hour Studio One stream. Thanks for sharing it with us, Al Scherz, and It's creating quite a buzz. And those who haven't tried it out, go to iowapublicradio.org. And Al, I know you've got a big smile about this, but I thought I'd end here with a local band because they are featured so prominently on our Studio One service. This is the Weepies. They recently performed on Java Blend, the program that I produce and host. And they are, in name, singer-songwriters Deb Talon and Steve Tannen. They relocated their young family from L.A. to Iowa City not too long ago. But because you're smiling, and all the Studio One staff, and because of all of Iowa Public Radio staff, and anybody who tunes in is smiling, here's a performance of Crooked Smile by the Weepies. Thanks so much, Al.
You're welcome. Thanks, Ben.
Do, 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 do. Hey, Crooked Smile, it would never work between you and I. I know it's true, I still love you, you know I do. Do, 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 do. Do, 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 do. Don't try no more, but it is not because you're lazy. Without a doubt, you figure out that you are crazy. It gets hazier the way we were. I stayed with her, left you with another broken heart.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.